here we are. Welcome to the Chelsea Skidmore Show. I am joined today by my husband, Stephen Randolph, and my father, Michael Skidmore.
A.K.A.
Hey, hi. How are you?
A.K.A. Mr. Steele?
Kid Mike Steele.
Kid Mike Steele. I gave myself that name because I feel it sounds younger.
Where did Kid Mike Steele come from? You've been calling yourself different names my entire life.
That's true.
By Bill for a long time.
That's true.
Growing up, I'd say, Dad, he'd go, call me Bill. I was like, who the fuck is Bill? I want my dad.
I don't know how I came up with that name. It's a random thing, and I really don't know how, because I didn't even have any friends called Bill.
You knew I had no friends called Bill, so you figured it was a safe name?
No, the name just invariably just came to me. I don't understand how. Kid Mike Steele was, I fashioned that after Kid Rock. Because I thought that was kind of cute and young sounding. And right now, don't call me Michael. Call me Mike. It's much younger going forward.
So what do you want?
Call me Mike in going forward. Do not call me Michael.
Mike.
It's much younger.
And you met your granddaughter today for the first time. And you introduced yourself to Gia as Grandpa Steele.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to work on a few different names.
Is Steel from Blue Steel from Zoolander? Is that
it's from a T-shirt I saw in London called Flesh and Steel, and I thought that was the most amazing T-shirt.
That's a cool name. That is a cool
Flesh
name.
Flesh and Steel,
which I think is still a great T-shirt logo T-shirt.
Well, I love it. Well, how do you like being in L.A.? You live in New York.
Yeah, I live in Manhattan in the Chelsea section downtown.
You've lived in New York your whole life.
I did. I mean, I lived in Long Island. And after college, I moved to Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, as you know, we went to Westchester and then back to Manhattan.
You grew up in Merrick in Long Island.
Yeah, it was about 10, 15 minutes next to Jones Beach, near Jones Beach.
Which is where Lindsay Lohan is from.
My town.
And Scott Disick. Didn't you know his parents?
Scott Disick wasn't from Merrick, though.
No, the parents were.
No.
I thought they were.
No, they were just great friends of mine.
You knew Scott Disick's parents?
I dated his mother.
What? You did?
Didn't I tell you that?
No, but talk closer to the microphone, please.
Well, she was dating, she was a gorgeous girl. She was a model for Ford magazine. Wait, do you know who we're talking about? Scott Disick's mother.
Do you know who Scott Disick is? The guy who's married to the Kardashian
girl? Part of me thought he was my son.
Wait, what?
Whoa, really?
Because I was having an affair with his mother.
What?
Wow.
You didn't tell you this?
No.
I think I told John this.
Get the video going.
Bonnie.
Okay, we have to make sure. Are we talking about the same people?
Yes.
Scott Disick, the person from the Kardashians.
His mother and father were very close friends of mine.
Okay.
And actually, his father shared a beach house with me one summer in West Hampton.
Really?
Bonnie.
Oh, it is Bonnie. She died.
They both did.
Oh.
He's not lying. Okay.
Scott. Wait, so you're telling me this woman was a model?
She was gorgeous.
Really?
He kind of looks like John.
Look at Scott Disick.
Wait, he kind of looks like John.
He does look like John.
Are you saying you think he's your kid?
Part of me thinks he is.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
You've never told me this.
I thought I told John that. He looks just like you, brother.
This is a great podcast.
Wait, this is
Beverly Hills Housewives.
That's so weird because I told someone recently that he kind of looks like my brother now.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
I think so.
I recently said that.
And he's into fashion too.
Very good looking guy.
So I could see his mother being, he's a really good looking guy.
Right. Yeah. He's a handsome guy.
But he fell off a little. He looks a little mentally ill.
He's still good looking.
I always say he's a handsome guy.
You walk him around Silver Lake and girls are going to look.
Yeah.
So what happened? How'd you have the affair with Scott Disick's mom?
I went to their wedding too at Tavern on the Green.
So how do you know them?
She was dating Gene Pressman, whose grandfather was Barney Pressman, and Fred, his father was Fred, who owned Barney's.
Yeah.
And we had a beach house in West Hampton, Gene, myself, and Andy Polsky. And he was friends with Gene, and through Gene, and Gene was like my best friend growing up. when I was in my early 20s, and he became, we were very close friends. We had loads of friends, and he was dating Bonnie, and then Jeffrey started dating her, and then Jeffrey married her. I went to their wedding, and then Jeffrey got into some, he got arrested. I think it was for selling something. I don't know.
Drugs?
I don't know. He got arrested and he wound up going to jail, I think, for like 6 months.
And you hooked up with Bonnie?
Those days, everybody hooked up with everybody.
It wasn't personal.
While she was married and her husband was in jail, you hooked up with her?
I'm afraid to say yes.
And then she shortly got pregnant thereafter?
It was around, yeah.
So couldn't they calculate like that she got pregnant from someone else?
That's what I'm thinking.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
This is so weird.
So nowadays with DNA testing, right? You want to see your nationality, your ethnicity. It also does, unbeknownst to you, a parental search. So I don't know. I have a friend who was Italian. He wanted to see how Italian he was, right? One day.
Right.
And it goes, bong, parental match. He was my age. He never had kids. He was on my podcast talking about it. And he said, there's got to be a mistake. And this lady said, do you want to meet your kids? We had a wild night in Hollywood in 2001. We didn't have exchange cell phone numbers. You have a kid. And he met the kid. So this, I mean, we could find this out.
Yes. I don't know if I want to pursue it.
Okay.
I don't think Scott does either. And the funny thing is, I mean, isn't this every guy's, not greatest fear, but it's in the back of every guy's mind.
That they hope they didn't get a girl pregnant.
That all of a sudden there's going to be a knock on the door, just like.
Yes.
And what was the guy's name? Remember that film with what's his name? Meet the Parents. What's the actor's name?
Ben Stiller.
And there's a knock on the door and there's a younger version of himself. Was it in that film?
Was it?
I didn't see
Not
part
in
three.
Meet
and
the Parents.
There was a kid that looked, he said, this is your son. And the son looked just like Ben Stiller in
I
the film.
I vaguely know what you're talking about, but I don't know what movie
so
that
Chelsea
is.
So Chelsea could be Scott Disick's brother.
Yep.
Why didn't you ever tell me this?
I thought I did. I told
no.
John. John knows all
these
about
things
this.
Come out later in life, right?
No, but this was I told your brother this years ago.
Huh?
I thought I told you as well.
It's weird because him and John look alike.
Yeah,
very much. Even his wife said that, Royce.
Wow. Oh, really?
Yeah, she said the same thing.
That's wow. So wild.
And does Royce know about this? That they could be brothers?
Yeah, but I told John. John tells Royce everything.
So you hooked up with her, and then she became pregnant, and then were you like, oh, I wonder if that was from me?
I didn't really think about it at all, no.
Until you realized she had a son?
No, I didn't realize it. And then I bumped into Jeffrey just when Scott moved to L.A. to become an actor. I bumped into him in front of Barney's, and he goes, Michael, here's my son Scott. And...
wow.
He showed me a picture of like one of those commercial photographs.
A headshot?
Headshot. I said, yeah, he just moved to L.A. He's trying to be an actor.
Scott was trying to be an actor?
Yeah. That's when he first moved to L.A. He was trying, because his father said to me, look, here's a picture of my son.
Yeah.
Great looking guy. I'm
he's
a fan.
He's 39 and, years old.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
For the timing?
Yeah. Well, John's 37.
Yeah. So this would have been 2 years, before you met mom.
This was before I got married. Yeah, I know.
He looks exactly like my brother.
Wow.
What the fuck?
Wow.
But I'm not trying to exaggerate.
But the story is funnier if it is.
Well, it's a true story.
Yeah.
You know, and she was a lovely, I really liked Bonnie. Everyone loved Bonnie. She was, and the funny thing, she was like 5'7", and in those days, you had to be minimum 5'8". But, you know, just like that English actress that was
Kate Moss.
Yeah, Kate Moss. I mean,
she was 5'7".
I met her too in Paris at Le Bain Douche.
When you say you,
she ignored
you had to,
me though.
You had to be a minimum 5'8 to date you or to get into modeling?
5'8 to get into modeling.
Now explain that, because the fans don't know your modeling connection, your connection to clothing yet. So they don't know you yet. So Michael was a big time fashion guy, and he was in linens, in garments, in the fashion.
He's a buyer.
Which
is called
for
a fashion merchandising manager, right?
I was the senior vice president of Barney's New York.
Senior vice president of Barney's New York.
And I brought in all the major designers.
Many people don't know.
And
you made Barney's what it was today.
Business.
And I'm saying what it was because unfortunately it shut down last year.
It's terrible.
So let's get into Barney's. And right before Barney's, is it true that you, and I'm speaking like a lawyer because we've been watching the Johnny Depp case. Is it true that you worked for UFO before Barney's?
Correct.
What's UFO?
UFO were those baggy pants.
Oh, yeah. Like Jinkos?
Parachute jeans. Pants?
Yes.
They were like, you know, they were famous 90s. For overalls.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. Now I remember. Yeah.
I worked for them. And
as a buyer, what did you do for them?
I was a salesman in the five boroughs. I sold the collection. I was involved in the design too, a little bit, not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It was a group thing.
So you're living in New York, and then how do you start working for Barney's? What year was this, and what was Barney's like then?
It was 1974, and I was at a show at the McAlpin Hotel, from which all the jean companies and apparel companies, not only jean companies, were showing their collections to buyers.
So sort of like a magic, like what magic
exactly
is in
like,
Vegas.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So a small, exactly right. And my next door neighbor, who also I grew up with and went to high school with, Peter Beckerman, came to my booth with Gene Pressman and introduced me and said, "Hey, what time are you getting off work? We'll meet up afterwards." And a few hours later, Gene comes over and he goes, "Hey, Mike, how you doing? I just met you through Peter." I go, "Yeah." And he said, I said, "Where's Peter?" I go, "Oh, he had to leave." He says, "What are you doing now?" I said, "Well, I'm getting off work." He goes, "Well, let's walk around, try and pick up some girls." So I immediately picked up this girl I know that was gorgeous in 2 minutes. What was your move back then? I knew her.
How did she pick up girls? She used to actually
work for Granny Takes a Trip on 62nd Street, where all the rock stars used to go to. And I lived in that building right next door, where Rod Stewart, David Bowie, all of them, they all bought these snakeskin boots for $200.
Mm.
It was the most popular thing. It was a great store. It was a very small store. And I pick up this, because she worked at Granny's Take a Trip, so I knew her. We went back to Gene's house. Two Quaaludes later, the three of us are in bed together.
What?
Wow.
That first night you met Gene?
First day, yeah, it was early evening.
Wait, you guys had a threesome?
Yeah.
It was the 70s. It was
the
Quaaludes.
70s.
Chelsea?
Oh my God. Okay.
So it was great, great. The next day, I get a phone call. He lived two blocks away. I was on 62nd and 2nd. He lived on 60. He was 61st and 3rd. The next day, I get a phone call at 10 o'clock at night. "Hi, what are you doing?" I said, "Nothing. I'm just chilling." He goes, "Come over right now." I go, "What?" He goes, "Come over right now," and hangs up. I go over there. Another gorgeous girl.
What?
This went back and forth for about a month.
What?
We took a beach house that summer in West Hampton, and that summer we tried to kiss as many girls as we could.
It's a great goal. Our friend
at
Ari
the
Manis
end of the summer,
goal.
At the end of the summer, I was trying to kiss as many girls as we could. He said, "You know, Michael, you got great taste. I just joined my dad's company, and I'm trying to change it. I want to make it more hipper. I'm really jealous of Bloomingdale's and Bergdorf Goodman. I want to really get the men's thing going, make it a much hipper store. You got great taste. I want you to join my company." And I said, "Okay." So I interviewed with his father,
Fred.
And then about 2 or 3 weeks later, I'm having dinner with him at Maxwell's Plum, which was a very cool restaurant on 64th and 1st. And that time, that area was a very popular area. And he said to me, "Have you got a passport?" I said, "Yes, I do," because I was going to go to London with my girlfriend at the time, who was in London for that 2 months to visit her parents in the summer. But I decided not to go. And I said, "Why?" He goes, "Oh, my dad wants to hire you."
Oh, wow.
2 weeks later, I'm in Paris.
Wow.
Can we break now? Can we do a break?
You have to go to the bathroom? Yeah, go ahead. Well, my dad goes to the bathroom. Me and Steven are going to do a quick chat.
Hi.
Gia, hi. How are you?
Good. I'm rocking Gia with one foot and holding our dog Jagger, who's a jealous, jealous brother, in a headlock with my right hand.
It's a lot of multitasking. It's when you have the baby. This is our first podcast at home with the baby and the dog at the same time. There's a lot of action. Everything is one-handed when you have a baby.
Yeah, everything's one-handed. I have a cigar.
Steven, the day Gia was born, Steven started smoking cigars.
I don't know what the hell happened. It wasn't a conscious choice. It chose me.
Scott, Steven's brother, showed up at the hospital with two celebratory cigars, and it didn't stop.
I have one right now. I have it with me at all times.
It's once you become a dad, you're handed a baby and a cigar.
Yeah. It's a girl.
And cigar. That's a Cuban.
Yeah. The cigar.
Yeah. We love it. All right. And we're back. Thank you, Michael.
All right. So
Cuban cigars, you know? The smoker. Commercial. I don't know. So you're going to Paris two weeks in. Hold on. And let me stop you right there. So at this time, what was Barney's like?
Barney's was known for a discount store.
It was like a Saks Off Fifth at this point?
Yes.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, originally.
Barney's, Boys Town, off-price merchandise. But Gene's father at that time was just beginning to transform the company into a much higher level.
Okay.
More sophisticated. And he brought in Saint Laurent, Pierre Cardin, and he was the first one, actually, to introduce European strong-shouldered suits, which no one does, because prior to that, it was all natural shoulder clothing, like Polo, Greif. I'm trying to think of the other brands, all very natural shoulder American clothing. And he introduced strong-shouldered European-fitted clothing, and it took off like wildfire. And about within 1 year's time when I was there, Gene's father, Fred Pressman, who was a brilliant merchant, which he was my mentor, that's where I learned everything, he found Giorgio Armani. And he secured the name exclusively for America for $50,000.
Wow.
And
that Armani can only sell to Barney's.
Only Barney's. And at that time, Giorgio was a hair. He just started the business. Prior to that, he was a window dresser, like Simon Dunham.
Yeah, yeah.
And his collection was so far advanced than everyone. It was a different look. Because at that time, guys were wearing long dog collar. We call them dog collar shirts, which is a very pointed long collar shirts. Ill-fitting jackets. He introduced the sexy sport coat and small collar shirts, and it was immediately embraced by the Europeans. And we found that at that time, European fashion was ahead of America about a year. In a year's time, then the Americans embraced it.
It goes Europe, New York, Los Angeles, the world, right? Yeah.
And we used to say the French are the most stylish. The British have the ideas, and the Italians have the workmanship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it was, the craftsmanship, the workmanship, the sewing, the fabric, the qualities of the fabrics. Well, Britain
and then New York, through the fashion shows and stuff, advertise it to the world.
Thank you. So he got the brand, and once he secured the rights for Giorgio Armani, it was a vehicle for us to go out and get other great brands.
Right. Now, it's like excited? Building your resume, your it's portfolio. Like saying,
so the first thing we did was when we went to London, Browns of London was the best store in London.
Is that Thomas Brown? Or
not? Not Thomas. Okay. Brown. It was called Browns of London. It was on, I forget where it was on the show.
Like a Harrods
it was
type?
Better. If they carried Missoni, Giorgio Armani, Kenzo. I'm trying to rethink of the other brands. And, you know, this was 1975.
So is it like Bon Marché? Better. Okay. I
mean, more like Maxfield Blue.
Got it.
So we went to buy the line, and he says, I don't know. We heard you guys are a discount store. And once we said, look, we're carrying Giorgio Armani, that opened up the doors.
Mm.
And that enabled Gene and I to secure a lot of great brands. And the brands we got, and that time was like I discovered Issey Miyake, Claude Montana. Let me think.
Comme des Garçons.
Dries Van Noten. Well, that was Japan like 2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Kenza, Sisuya, Clubman. I mean, it was a lot of French brands. What's that down company? Montclair.
Oh, we love Montclair. You discovered Montclair?
Yeah.
They were so expensive.
It was a French company originally, and they used to show at the SEM.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
They were great. Outerwear then. And then, so we secured a lot of brands. And we started to get it, a lot of brands. And Paul Smith, you wanted to hear the Paul Smith story?
Yeah.
Oh, so after we went to Brown's, I went back to the hotel. We're going to Mr. Chow's for dinner that night. And there's a knock on my door. So I figured out room service, whatever, the maid's coming in. And I opened the door and he goes, "Hi, my name is Paul Smith. I heard you're at my mate works at Browns of London, the shop, and I heard you bought the Browns of London wholesale collection for Barney's. And I'm working with the same factory, and I would like to show you my shirt collection." I only had shirts. And I said, "Sure, come on in. I got a half hour before dinner." He lays out these cool plaid shirts, and they were really quite beautiful. And they were like European preppy, which was sort of the beginning of that direction at that time, where the Europeans took all the preppy, not so much surfing, but they're all American Brooks Brothers look, and they made it a little bit more stylish and more European. And they were great. And you know, it's funny how I remember certain prices. And I remember, I said, "Wow, these shirts are great." And they were £7 first course, which translated, the pound was like $1.60 at a time. So it was $10 first course. It landed for $3, and we sold them for $38. I bought 600 shirts, because we did a lot of business at Barney's downtown. They sold out in 3 weeks.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it myself. They sold out so fast, because we had nothing like it.
Yeah.
We had the basic, like, all-American look in shirts. And
so you brought over those fun prints.
They were mostly, a lot of them were plaids and some stripes as well, and some checks, some gingham checks. But they had the colorations, and then from there,
yeah,
we just expanded, and we just, Gene and I went out, and we tried to get every cool brand. And it's funny, and Gene's father said to me, he goes, "Michael, don't worry about the trends. Just go out there and try and find yourself, try and find the most beautiful merchandise you can find, and I do not mind being stuck with beautiful merchandise." I never forgot that. Mm. And that's a great philosophical belief when it now, comes into fashion.
Can I ask a question here? So I've asked you business advice before, sales advice before. You were basically, and so you were going out and you had to close these deals. You're flying to Europe, flying to Japan, and you had to get, you had, they were going out paying you to do this. You had to close the deal. You had to get the line. What are some, just some bullet point factoids to sales points to new salespeople, new people starting business, you know, a lot of new ambitious people. What made you such a success? Like, what was your mindset as you're walking into, hey, I've got to have this line for Barney's, and no is not an option. You know, you're flying over to Japan. You better get it done.
Yeah.
What's your mindset?
Well, there's a couple of things. The first thing is we tell them, Gene, Gene used to always say, just keep on talking until they say yes.
Really? Okay.
That was one of Gene. And that sort of worked. He kept on talking. They go, "All right, we'll sell you the collection." The next thing was we told them, we said, "Listen, we follow a Japanese philosophy. If we both agreed that you want to sell us the collection and we want to buy it. And the Japanese philosophy is we believe that you're, the number one reason why I want to buy your line is because you're talented." I play into their ego. Mm-hmm. "You're talented, you're definitely creative, and we are a firm believer if someone is talented as a fashion designer, they're not going to be not talented next season or the season after. Other companies, other retail stores, if they don't like your collection, they may skip on it. We want to build your brand, and we are not going to put it on sale until the end of June or the beginning of December. We're not going to mind. We're going to house you next to Giorgio Armani or
Kenzo." So you're selling longevity.
We're saying if the next collection, if we don't love it, we're still going to buy it. And that's the Japanese philosophy. Yeah. Once we agree to do business,
a partnership,
we will always do business. We will find a way. And that resonated with a lot of designers. But the first thing is I played into their ego. And that I played in, and rightly so, it wasn't dishonest, because I want to buy the line because I really think they're very talented.
Mm-hmm. As an artist myself, someone that's going to be pitching and doing all that stuff, if someone said to me, "Hey, we love what you're doing. If it's not this show, it's the next. We're going to sign you to do a deal because we believe in you so much. You don't have to perform right now. Just, you know, we know you're going to be great." I would produce good work because I'd be like, wow, they believe in me. My guard would be down and I could really get going and doing my art, not worried about getting my head chopped off. So it makes the artist feel comfortable and produce their best work.
Yeah. So those were probably the two factors as we kept on talking. And we told them about the line, you know, lines. We never lied. I mean, we told them the brands we were carrying, what we're going to do and how we're going to. And
Did you tell any lies during this time?
We played into the reek. What?
A little fake it till you make it?
No, no, okay. never. Because don't forget, they saw Gene and I, and Gene was a, you know, we had a, you know, we were kind of stylish. We were good dressers. And, you know, Barney's had a very good reputation. It's just that we had to convince them it's no longer a discount store, that we're carrying regular. We're not going to put your merchandise on sale.
Let me ask you this. Did you ever close any deals on Quaaludes?
No, but I did once, a couple of times we were smoking weed, and it was too, we kept on laughing and they got mad at us.
Who was one of the lines that you brought to Barney's that started off really small and today they're like fucking huge?
Prada and Gucci.
So you brought...
And Dries and Paul.
Yeah.
And all the Japanese.
So you, so Prada and Gucci were small when you discovered them in Italy?
Issey Miyake, Come to Gosan, Yoji, Takeo Kikuchi, Grass, Pasha, Matsuda... who else? Those were the main Japanese designers. They were great. Paul Smith was, you know, as I said, Dries Van Noten.
Let me ask you this. So stores like...
Kenzo was pretty big at the time.
So Gucci, like, has their
own... I'll tell you the Gucci story.
Wait, hold on. So Gucci, like, has their own stores. Did they have their own boutiques at this time?
No.
Oh, so first they were in stores like Barney's, Gucci, and then they got their own stores?
I'll tell you the story.
Okay.
Gucci was famous for those suede slip-on,
yeah,
driving shoes. I don't know if they were driving shoes or loafers.
Smoking shoes kind of
things. With the gold
things.
Buckle.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was the thing. And then what happened was the women's president, Bergdorf Goodman, recommended to Gucci to hire Tom Ford,
mm-hmm,
to become the designer. Now, at that very same time, I had this idea to do a whole new 70s kind of collection. This was like 19... Now I'm jumping around a little bit. I think this
That's
was
all right.
Like... Well, I think Tom Ford started maybe early 80s. I'm trying to remember, late 70s. So what happened was I was trying to reinvent Pierre Cardin. So I figured very 70s, I'll try and I contacted the Cardin people, but they never could get it together. At the same time, I bumped into a friend of mine who had this amazing store in Amsterdam called Reflections. And he said, Michael, I just saw this line in Florence called Gucci, you know, Gucci, but they completely reimagined the collection. They hired this new designer. It's great. So I said, fine. And in those days, you know, I hear a lead, I jump on it. I don't wait till next season, because if you wait till next season,
someone else,
Saks, Bergdorf, you know, all the other stores will jump on it. Bloomingdale's. So I immediately run over there, and the sales manager I knew, because he was prior to this position he had now at Gucci, he was the sales manager at Giorgio Armani. So I knew him, and I said, listen, I want to look at the collection. And I said, fine. I looked at the collection. It was mostly leathers. And I'm looking at these leathers. I'm going, oh, my God, these leathers are they're great.
Mm-hmm.
These are great designs, great leather jackets. And leather jackets was very big at that time. I think it's always leather jackets are always good, but it was very popular item at that time. Everybody was wearing leather jackets. And I'm looking at the line. I'm going, these are great. And I said to him, and as I'm looking at it, my eyes glance over to a far corner. I see Tom Ford peeking out of a door looking and watching me. I thought it was him. I wasn't sure.
He was young then too, right?
Yeah.
A young guy.
So I said to the salesman, I said, listen, I really like the collection. Who bought it in New York? He goes, well, nobody. Bergdorf was here. I said, Bergdorf was here? Well, they were here about five times already. I went, what? Well, they came with the buyer, then the merchandise, and they came in. I said, forget that. I'll give you an order right now for $100,000. I'll give you $50,000 for the Beverly Hills store and $50,000 for the New York Madison Avenue store. Or was it down? I think I gave
Chelsea.
You another $20,000 for the 17th Street. I said, I'll give you a $100,000 order. And I had that power. You know, I had a big open to buy, and, you know, they gave it to me, and as long as I didn't screw it up, and I never did. So on the spot, I gave him an order for $100,000, and I got the exclusive for Gucci for New York and L.A. for 1 year or 2 years. I think it was 1 year. At the same time, I told the women's buyers at Barney's, I just saw this men's collection. You guys should look at the women's, and they never did.
Mm.
Or they waited a season or two, and from that, they never got the collection.
Oh,
and that's
wow.
what it was in those days. And probably to this day, you see a collection, you gotta act right away. I think with anything in life.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you see something, follow your intuition. Don't just wait around because someone else is going to come in and take it.
Instincts is everything. I'm a firm believer in that.
Instincts is everything.
Everything. You know, don't second guess yourself.
So how quickly, once you got all these new lines in, did Barney start to grow and become more popular?
Well, then we started with the women's.
Mm.
I'm jumping around.
So it was initially only men's?
Well, I'll tell you how it was only men's. I'll tell you how the women started. Gene's father came over to me and said, listen, we got this little area in the store. Well, what should we do with it, Michael? I said, put some sneakers in there. And sneakers at that time was not fashionable. There was no fashion sneakers. There was no buzz about trainers. And in London, mm-hmm. Europe, they call it trainers. So, and they go, and Gene's father said, you know, he said, no. I said, well, why don't we try some women's? He goes, all right. So Gene and I started the women's.
Mm.
And those lines, we went to Sem, which was like the magic. And in those days, you had to go fast because what happened was after two or three days at the shows, these companies and designers would put up signs to read sold out.
Hmm.
You never see that in any magic show where a store or a designer, rather, I mean, a wholesale company would say sold out. So we had to go. So we got Clubman, Castle Bajac. Well, that was a great collection in those days. He did a lot of things with Keith Haring. I think he employed Keith Haring to do some artwork for his home, or I don't know if he did anything on his clothing. And, Kenzo was already established. But we bought it big. Kenzo was the hottest brand in those days, early mm-hmm. mid-70s. They had a store in Place de Victoire that was packed all the time. We used to always make a point of going there for inspiration. And I never met him, though. And Christian Ajard, he was amazing. And Saint Laurent, Chloe, I mean, all those wonderful brands. Because France was, and Italy was just, Basile. I'm trying to think of the Italian brands we bought. Versace, he was great. And then we went to Italy, and then, of course, Armani, Versace, Basile. At that time, Versace was designing a blouse collection for a company called Callaghan. And I went to buy the line. They were $200 retail at that time. And that was very expensive for women's blouses, but they were the most beautiful blouses I've ever seen.
Mm.
I mean, it was incredible. Then he went out to get his own collection.
Did you ever meet him?
I met him on the plane, but he didn't really speak English that time, and I was talking to his boyfriend a little bit. But he was invited. We had a party for Giorgio Armani, Johnny Versace, the FTM group, which is Basile, Callaghan, Massimo Albini, which is a major. I think he was an illustrator and a designer. Moschino was there, I think. At Gene's house for a barbecue, and they were all
wow,
there.
That's so fun.
Okay, hold on. I'm gonna go to the bathroom.
You have to pee again?
Yeah, but the coffee.
Oh, okay. And we're back. Steven, hey,
yeah.
It's just us now again,
hey.
Taking a break. We have Jagger here. Gia is waking up. What's going on with you, bud?
Nothing much. I'm just sitting here. I got a couple hours of work to do, so that's on my mind. I am...
This is a great time for us to hear about your dates out of the gate.
My dates out of the gate. Great. I will be with Jay Larson. When does this come out? Soon?
Next Wednesday.
I will be with Jay Larson in Texas. Texas, if you want to see me, you got a couple chances to see me. I'll be at the Secret Show with Brian Redband show June 2nd. I will be at the Creek in the Cave. Two shows June 3rd, two shows June 4th in Austin, Texas. I'm going to be opening up for Jay Larson's special there. I'm going to be doing Des Moines, if you want to see me. Check out Josh Wolf's tour dates. I'll be opening up for Josh in Des Moines, I believe, on the 17th, 18th, and 19th. And then I will be back in Texas in San Antonio on the 20th, 21st, and 22nd, I believe.
So pretty much every weekend in June, you'll be on the road.
I'll be on the road, yeah.
And we'll be missing you.
Well, I'll be missing you. Who's going to help take care of the baby?
I will be mostly doing it, and maybe my mom. Okay. Yeah, either my mom or my dad or something will figure it out.
Okay.
When Robin comes back, goes back to New York, I'll come back.
And we'll figure that out.
And scene.
And dad's back. All right. So.
And then from there, it was just a metamorphosis. So we just, that was, you know, we were, you gotta remember, I was in my early 20s and mid 20s, and Gene was a couple years younger than me. We were on a mission to make Barney's the best store in the world. And it was nonstop. And then we went, so then what happened with Japan was.
We moved to Japan because they were opening.
Japan was like late 70s, early 80s. And what happened was in Japan was a mutual friend of ours, Lance Karish, was a designer for a company called Whistle Stop, and he was like our best friend. And he said to me and Gene, you guys got to go to Japan. Things are happening. And we said, what? They only wear kimonos there. And that's what it was. I mean, nobody went to Japan. They said, Michael, Gene, you got to make a trip to Japan. Because he used to go to Hong Kong for production, but he would always stop in Japan for a weekend to go shop the stores and for inspiration. And because he worked with factories in Hong Kong, so he always made a stop there. And he said, so we said, okay, fine. So we went there, and that's where we found Come to Garçon, all the lines. Mm-hmm.
Come to Garçon, Yoji Yamamoto.
And they were so, yeah. Come to Garçon, Yoji, Isamiyaki, Pashu, Matsu. And they were just incredible. And what they did was they were sort of doing a hunting, fishing look, but they made it very European, very fitted. Not super fitted, but, you know, because in those days, the hunting, most of the men's clothes were too baggy, ill-fitting. But nobody knew any difference. But they were paid much more, and they were very big on expensive hardware, which really makes a garment look so much better when you go through the additional expense, which isn't more money than you think it is, for the right zippers, the right buttons, the right snaps. And they were very big on big bellow pocket jackets, hunting, fishing kind of look. Mm. And it was one that was great. So we found all, and funny, Maxfield Blue, Tommy Purse, was there the same time we were, as well as a friend of ours from Australia. I can't remember his name. He had a great store and a few other. It was like six stores in the world. We, Tommy, myself, I can't remember the other ones, that recognized, that found out that you got to go to Japan. It's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And we opened up a little section of Barney's, of Japanese store. And in those days, the third floor is where I had all the sportswear. And you had made mention to me about Andy Wall. He used to come to the store every Saturday afternoon. But he never bought anything because, you know, he was always wearing jeans, a white shirt, and a jean jacket. But the store was rocking on a Saturday mid-afternoon. All the guys from Chelsea would come down and because we had like a Disneyland of men, young men's fashions from which all these lines are made mention of. And I had a lot of British lines too, apart from Paul Smith. I'm trying to remember some of the other lines I had. They were great too. I had some pant lines. Jekyll and Hyde was another line. I can't remember the other lines. But there was a lot of cool British lines we used to carry as well. And
Andy?
Well, he used to come in. That's how he, you know, knew me. And he gave your mother and I the first interview in magazine.
That's cool.
When we're at a restaurant. But then I guess you want to go up to Studio 54?
Yeah, let's hear about Studio 54. Oh, well, actually, I do have one question. So that's kind of how you got Barney's going and developed it to what it is. Flash forward to being in there at the height of it just being so fabulous. Probably in like what? The early 2000s, like?
No, well, unfortunately, the company ended.
In 2008,
it went on Chapter 11 in 2000.
So then that was 2008. So I was trying to think about right before.
1975, well, we opened up the Madison Avenue store in 1997. That was probably the zenith of the company.
Okay.
It was when opening up.
So, like, when I was younger, I remember walking around, and it was just like, by then it was fully realized.
Fully developed, yeah.
That's what I'm... So that's probably in the early 2000s, right?
No, it was 1997.
Okay. So did you walk...
That's when we opened the Madison Avenue.
Did you have moments where you were walking around on all the floors, the store was buzzing, and you think, wow, I like built this.
We never thought of it that way.
Really?
No.
Really?
Because it was a slow transition from 1975 to 1997.
But you never had a moment like you looked around and you're like, whoa, like we made this to what it is today.
We never even thought of that. We sort of like...
Wow.
We sort of like... we had this vision implanted in our minds that it wasn't...
But no, I'm not saying this to be arrogant. Oh, because it was always transitioning.
It was a slow transition. And we just sort of knew... If we stayed with our plan to go out and find the best designers of the world and slowly bring them about, it was just like a slow metamorphosis.
So it was unfinished at that point.
He knew it was going to happen, so he wasn't
shocked.
We had
this, yeah, it was like,
wow.
We knew we would make this, we just knew it was going to, we would do it. I mean, at the risk, I'm not trying to sound arrogant or.
No, you don't sound arrogant. I'm just saying, like, did you guys ever stop to pat yourself on the back and be like, no. Wow, it really came together?
No, we were so busy thinking, who's next? Who's the new designer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, when we found Prada, they were a luggage brand. They never had clothes.
Really?
Really?
When I found Prada, Prada was probably the biggest seller. When Jean actually found Prada, they had the luggage. We bought the luggage, and then they started doing some shirts and a couple of knitwear pieces. So I bought the color. I'll tell you a funny Prada story. So I bought the Prada. So after they did the luggage, they decided to go into ready-to-wear. So I bought, they had some really nice shirts, very basic, but beautiful colors and great fitting shirts. And they did some great knitwear, a few jackets. So I gave them an order for 70,000, I'm trying to remember the number, 70,000 wholesale, which is like 200,000 retailer, because it's 30% to bring anyway. All right. And the collection came in, and we had these little rooms on the third floor in Madison Avenue for designers. Yoji had a room, Prada, Donna, we had a big business with Donna Karen, too. And Dries, and I'm trying to think of all the Mark, I think we had Mario. We had Marc Jacobs as well. We had them all. On a Saturday, the Prada room was the most popular room, and we did we sold the line out. I couldn't believe how, I mean, it was like 20 people in this little room buying everything. I said to myself, oh my God, this is I never saw so much activity and a line sell as quickly. Sold out as the first Prada collection I bought. So I go back to Europe the next season, and I said to myself, fuck it. I'm going to give them a huge order because I wanted to keep the exclusive. Gene had an exclusive with them, and, you know, you got to show that you're growing with them. And I was, you know, so I gave him an offer for $200,000.
Double.
Triple.
Oh.
I went from 7,200. I was a little nervous, but I loved it. Fast forward, a month later, we're in a big meeting at 20 buyers, men's, women's, and they look. We're reviewing all the numbers, and Gene says, wow, that's Prada. Wow, that really sold out. How much did you give? I said, well, I gave him 70,000. He goes, oh, how much did you give him this time? 80, 90? And I was too scared to tell him 200. I didn't tell him. I said, I don't remember. But it was a nice order, and I think I changed the subject, and I started freaking out. But I said to myself, you know, I'm not worried. I'm just going to hide the number because I know he'll freak out. Sure enough, it was sold right out.
Wow.
It was the first four or five. And Prada was the high. You go to the store on Via Monte Napoleone in Milan when they first opened the store, packed. It was like
It
was like Abercrombie & Fitch when that first opened up on Fifth Avenue when there was a line to get in.
And now do you see how like trendy it is today? Like a lot of people are doing Prada right now.
Yeah, that's true.
Or wearing it, sorry. So tell us about Studio 54.
Gene went to Syracuse and he was in the same fraternity as Stephen Rebell. And prior to opening, about a few months before Studio opened up, there was a club called Hurrah. Which was a cool club on 72nd Street near the Columbus Circle. And I was there, and Gene was there, and he comes over. We went separately, and I bumped into him, and he comes over with Stephen Rebell, and he goes, hey, Mike, have you got an extra Quaalude for my friend Stephen? And I said, yeah, I think I got an extra one.
So you always had Quaaludes. You were the Quaalude guy?
It was the drug of choice.
But you had the Quaalude connection?
No, everybody did.
Were they legitimate pills for like some medical thing, or were they always illegal?
I think they were for something, but I don't know what. Yeah. I don't remember.
For a good time.
So,
what do they make you feel like, Quaaludes?
Anything is possible. I would go up to any girl and start talking or slurring, and I would connect with her.
And,
I don't know, because...
And hoping that she was on Quaaludes too? And
no, I didn't care. It was like I don't know. It's like it gave you so much confidence.
Uh huh.
So I gave Stephen a Quaalude, and he never forgot it.
Mm.
So fast forward, opening a Studio 54. I know. Actually, I went to the opening, but it was so crowded.
So mm-hmm. you gave Stephen was it one was of like the 10, owners, right?
Yeah. Stephen
and you gave him his first Quaalude.
Yeah, not his first Quaalude, but I gave him a Quaalude.
Oh, okay.
And Ian
Traeger.
Ian's sister. He owned the store. Ian's sister worked for my dentist, Teddy Aronson. So I knew Ian's sister very well. We were good friends.
Mm-hmm.
And Ian knew me through his sister. So I knew them both prior to Studio One open up. But Ian was never at the door. Stephen used to go to the door. And I think I met Stephen a couple of times also prior to the opening of Studio. There was a club called Club A, and I have this vintage scarf, and he goes, oh, I want to dress like Michael. And because, you know, those days we had the sport jackets rolled up to our elbows and a scarf around our neck. So he saw me, and we had some mutual friends. So but the opening night, it was so crazy. So I went the second night,
mm-hmm.
and then Steve saw me.
Was it a weekly club?
No, it was open every night.
Every night, wow.
And then Steven saw me, and he let me right in, you know. And the guys at the door saw that Steven let me in.
And that's all you needed.
Plus, the guys at the door was Mark, and I can't remember the other guy. They would come to Barney's anyway, and they knew I was the buyer at Barney's. So it was all good. And Studio was amazing. It was just like, you know.
How often did you go to Studio?
Well, I had to be at the office at 9:30, I would go twice a week. I would go like a Friday or a Saturday night. And there's always some kind of theme party during the week.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go like a Thursday night or a Wednesday. When there was a theme party, they always had great parties. Halloween parties were amazing. And I went to a couple of New Year's Eve parties. And like on the weekend. Because, you know, I had to be at work the next day. I had to be sharp.
And then how'd you meet my mom? Didn't meet her at a restaurant?
I was at a restaurant downtown. It was a Mexican restaurant. I can't remember the name. It'll come to me.
What was your pickup line?
I'm going to tell you. I was sitting at a table with Gene, his girlfriend Bonnie, who he married. Bonnie Pressman, not Bonnie Lyser, not the same Bonnie. Not the Bonnie Disick.
Yeah.
And Michael Hasban, who was a photographer who we hired, he was a pretty good photographer, we hired to do some ads for us. And the four of us are having dinner, and then Paul Cavaco with his wife Keisha Kiva, they were very famous stylists at the time. They actually styled, I'll tell you the Giorgio Armani show thing, the first show in America. I forgot to tell you about that. So I'll tell you, well, let me backtrack, and then I'll go back. So this is a great story. So we decided to have a fashion show for Giorgio Armani.
Mm-hmm.
And we opened up a big tent in the parking lot on 7th Avenue and 17th Street. So Gene's father said, listen, Michael, we want you to go to Milan, get all the clothes, and bring it back. I said, okay. And I'm saying, how am I going to do this?
Mm-hmm.
So I go to Via Monte Napoleone, it was Via Dorini, where the first office was. Across the street from Via Dorini was a luggage store. I bought 25 suitcases. I brought it over to the store. We packed up all the clothes. And I said to myself, now how the hell am I going to get this through customs? Fortunately, I was dating a girl from an English girl who worked for an Italian company called Basile. And she went with me to the airport with the 25 suitcases. We go to the customs guy, and he goes, you can't bring this on the plane. And I said, ask him how much. $500.
Wow.
So I gave him $500. They let me bring it
under the table?
Under the table. Wow. It was 1977.
And they let you bring 25 suitcases of Armani onto the
people
plane.
People don't
onto
the plane without going
through.
Usually
oh, without going through customs.
Without going through customs.
Nice.
So I brought it back, and then Paul Cavaco, who was...
the stylist.
The stylist was sitting with my ex Robin at
my
the
mom.
Next table. Your mom.
So Robin at the time was a model.
On her way to Milan to live with her boyfriend
Mario Lavezzi,
who was the manager of Laura Donna Padilla, who was like a Madonna in Milan, like she was.
He was
like
a producer too, right?
Yeah, like was a music producer. He was. She was like he produced Laura Donna Padilla. She was like a female Madonna in Milan at that time.
So my mom's a model. She's at the same restaurant you're at. She's having dinner with a stylist. You're having dinner with the Barney's.
She was
people.
With 10 other people.
She's with 10 other people. After this night, she's supposed to go back to Milan to her boyfriend.
Or that week, I think.
Okay.
So we kept on turning around looking at each other. So Jean says, go talk to her. I said, how am I going to talk to her? She's sitting with 12 people. As soon as I walk over there, 12 people are going to stop what they're doing and like say and listen. So I said, she'll go to the bathroom. I'll wait. Mm-hmm. So I waited. And Jean goes, she's not going to go. And Bonnie said, relax, she'll go. She goes to the bathroom. I wait outside the bathroom door. I said, hey, how you doing? Da 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 da. Listen, you're on your way tomorrow. Listen, you're free tomorrow night? Maybe we can have a dinner together. She said, okay.
She said, okay, even though she had a boyfriend and she was going back to Italy to see him?
She was 24 years old.
Okay.
So the next night, she comes over. We go to dinner at a restaurant called Van Damme. Great restaurant. And then I took her to... I'm trying to remember the club to see the Boomtown Rats. What was the name of that club on 11th Street? Was it a rock and roll club? My friend was one of
CBGB.
The 12. CBGB. It was that was more punk hardcore. Mm. The Ritz, that was the name of the club. So we went there, and two of my friends were one of 12 owners that owned it. So we got right in, we sat upstairs, and...
You went to the bathroom and made out with someone else.
I didn't make out. It was Narit.
Yeah.
I didn't make out with her. Oh. I was just talking to her. And
Or doing Quaaludes in the bathroom.
No, I was doing
Coke.
A little bit.
Coke, right?
Not a lot.
I remember the story.
Yeah, a little Coke.
So you disappeared on the date and you're doing Coke
no,
in the bathroom.
No, she was standing. It was in the back room. She was waiting outside. And she said, what's she doing with Narit?
Yeah.
But we were just talking, doing a Coke. And then Robin wound up staying the night. And the next day I said to her, I don't want you to go to Milan. Why don't we go to, let's go to the Hamptons. I mean, I didn't have a car, so I thought, let's go to Fire Island. We took a seaplane that weekend to Fire Island. In those days, seaplane was $60. Mm-hmm. I think it was like $30 each to go to Fire Island. Or $60 each, I can't remember. It was either $30 or $60 each. I take it to this gay hotel, which was awesome in Cherry Grove. Mm-hmm. She immediately thinks I'm gay. Because we're the only straight people there.
Yeah.
I smoked a joint. I convinced her to smoke a joint. She lost track of time. I went out to make a reservation. She goes, oh, he's disappeared for 2 hours. He's definitely gay. And then after that weekend, she moved in. I said, call you. She called from a payphone on the beach to Mario saying, I changed my mind. I'm not coming.
How did you get her to not go?
I told her. I said, I want you to move to New York. Stay with me. Yada, yada, yada.
And she goes, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
She moved in 2 years later.
No, 2 weeks later.
She moved in 2 weeks later. 2 years later, we got married.
Yeah. Wow. So tell us about what I was like growing up. I was a bad kid. I was a troublemaker.
Well, you were actually.
Remember you would say, stop Tom Greening?
Yeah. Well, you were very... You were very outgoing.
Very outgoing.
Like you would walk, as a matter of fact, I remember I gave you a movie camera, your mom gave you a video camera. And one time at the airport, you were videoing, taping everybody.
Yeah, I used to love
like
videotaping
go up to people,
everyone.
Videotaping everyone. You were a troublemaker.
Do you remember?
You'd like to make trouble. You like to get a rise out of people.
Yeah.
Especially with your brother's friends.
Do you remember when I had the party and the cops came?
I was in New York at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Lynn called me and I drove back.
Yeah.
And
were you pissed?
I'm trying to remember.
You know what I did one time? You were watching us at the house and you were passed out and you were asleep. I snuck out. I took a train to the city. I took ecstasy and when I was 15 and went to the Roxy, that club. And then I came back that morning and you never knew I was gone.
I never knew this. I'm hearing this.
When I was 15.
Who'd you go with?
I went with Allegra's brother, Walter.
Oh my God. 15 years old. They let you in the club?
You know, you have a fake ID then.
It's true.
Do you remember I was always getting drunk and I'd come home passed out? I remember one time I came home and I had like alcohol poisoning and you just said, throw her in the bathtub. And then you just walked out of the room.
I remember you were throwing up and I thought this would be a good video for you to put in your school. And you were told when you were running for president of the school or something.
Oh, yeah.
And we could say, I'm going to do this. And we had the video of you throwing up.
That's funny.
I tried to run for president of my school.
Yeah.
And the teachers wouldn't let me because I was a really big troublemaker. Aww. And I made cupcakes and passed them out. And I was like, vote for me. But I was just like, I was like the bad kid.
That's cute.
But I was trying to like do something fun and be the president.
That's cute.
And then when it came and I had like a really fun speech that I did. And then when it came time to do the votes, the teachers got together and they're like, we can't let her be president.
Oh,
so they made up some sort of lie on like something that happened that I did wrong that wouldn't like have me.
You.
They disqualified me on purpose because they didn't want me to be president. And I was so upset.
Some Ryan Murphy, like,
I remember that.
Yeah.
I thought
hurtful.
Mom made cookies, but I think maybe it was cupcakes.
Cupcakes. Mm.
You should do a documentary on it.
Do you remember when we went to eat at Kraft and we were sitting with Nobu and I was sitting on his lap?
It wasn't Kraft, it was Town.
Oh, Town.
I don't remember you sitting on his lap.
We were at the table next to Nobu, Matsuhisa Nobu.
And Richie Notar.
And we were with Richie. And Nobu was with like a mistress in a kimono. And she had geisha makeup on. I remember this. And then we went over there. And then Nobu said, sit on my lap. Just like because I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And he gave me wine. And I was drinking
wine
sitting on his lap.
I remember they were sitting next to us.
Huh.
Well, my Nobu story was, well, I shouldn't say it because, yeah,
okay.
I can't say that story. All right, so.
So you saw a UFO one time.
What?
You saw a UFO one time?
We both
I was in
UFOs.
Montauk when I was like, when Gina and I had the house in West Hampton, they went back and I decided I had some vacation days. And I was at the Montauk Yacht Club, not the Montauk Yacht Club, the West Hampton Beach Club. And I looked, it was like 6 o'clock at night. I swear to God, I saw a spaceship go right by. I was in disbelief. It went by so
fast. Wow.
It stopped in front of the West Hampton Beach Club, and then it went right by.
Wow.
And I said to myself, was that a spaceship? I was all by myself, and I didn't think much of it. Then I woke up the next day, and I said, holy shit.
Yeah, that's cool.
But you know, I was in disbelief.
Yeah, I saw one in Hollywood. Three of them hooked together, made a triangle, and shot off into hyperspace. And I was like, did I just see that?
Yeah.
It's like you question yourself.
And let's finish it up with telling us why you got kicked off Tinder.
Oh, God, really? That's how we end this conversation? I was going to talk about Boo.com, the first internet fashion company. But we could kick it off. We could say that for another podcast.
You could talk about the first, but that was the first e-commerce website, right?
1999.
Well, you could talk about that.
I left
quickly.
Barney's because, unfortunately, the company was going through a Chapter 11. We were in partnership with the Japanese. It fell by the wayside. It was terrible. And Gene left. The family, Pressman family, had to leave, lost their power. A lot of senior people left. And I got this job offer to work for this British company called Boo.com. And it was the first active sportswear internet company.
No one had sold clothes online before?
I don't think so.
It was like the first e-commerce website.
Yeah, and the lines we carried, it wasn't Nike, it wasn't Adidas, it was New Balance, Vans, North Face, Patagonia, New Balance, I'm trying to remember all the brands. Helly Hansen.
Have I been pronouncing Adidas wrong this entire time?
Well, the Europeans say Adidas. Yeah. The Americans say Adidas. Helly Hansen, North Face, Patagonia. I'm trying to remember all these great snowboard. Bogner, I think we carried a little Bogner. All these great active sportswear companies that at that time was becoming fashionable.
Burton.
Because prior to that, they were just like functional utilitarian collections, but now they started becoming
snowboarding was
more
fashionable.
Stylish and fashionable.
Mm-hmm. Robin dresses like a snowboarder, a 90s snowboarder. I told her my that. Mom? She goes, yeah, and she goes, that's the look I'm going for.
Oh, really?
Yesterday, I go, you look like a 90s snowboarder. She goes, exactly. That's my look. Yeah. It's cool.
That's so funny.
So we were carrying all these brands. And then I even went back to Paul Smith, got his line, PS, the younger line. I went back to Donna Karan, got the DKNY line. And we wound up with all these lines, but unfortunately, the company was too early with regard to getting the functionalities in the back and the back door, the back end of the company, meaning with regard to having the website get every
the technology didn't work,
because in those days this was before the euro, so everything was like converted to it was a difficult. First of all, at that time in 1998-1999, people were afraid to use their credit card over the internet.
Oh yeah, this is before Y2K. This is like AOL days.
Nobody wanted to use their credit card, and it was before the euro, so it was all these different exchanges, plus the functionality of the website. When we first launched, it took Robin, my ex-wife, 2 hours to buy something.
Wow.
Because they didn't, you know, the IT guys, and this is a lesson learned. You know, we had these meetings, we say, oh, how's everything going with regard to getting the functionality of the website? They always go, yeah, it's going great. And then when it came to the actual launch date, they couldn't get it together.
That's like Elizabeth Holmes, who made Theranos. Remember the girl who made the blood?
She just
thing?
Lied.
I know.
She just lied about saying that you could take a sample.
But it's like you have a big idea, but then it doesn't.
The technology
couldn't catch up with the big idea.
But we bought all the great collections.
Yeah.
I bought all these great sneaker collections and active sportswear outerwear collections and Fila. I'm thinking all the tennis brands. I'm trying to remember. We had them all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny too, because it was a lot of convincing as well, because a lot of these brands said, listen, Michael, you know, if we go on the internet, all our stores are going to get mad at us for going on the internet.
That's so funny.
Because, you know, nobody had
and
websites.
And boy, were they wrong.
They said, oh, Michael, we can't sell you Fila because all our stores are going to complain about it. I said, listen, it's only going to bring about, and my reply was, it's only going to bring about greater brand awareness to your company.
And more business.
And more business, not only to your brand, but it's going to be greater brand, you know, name recognition. And in turn, a lot of people are going to go on the website and go, you know what, I'd rather go to the store. Mm. It's going to be good for everybody. That was my and it's true. That's what I firmly, and that's what it worked out to be.
Mm.
It only made the brand more popular. And the stores benefited from it, because not everyone was afraid to go on the web to buy things. They were like very suspicious of it.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll talk about that at greater length another time.
So why did you get kicked off Tinder?
Could you hold on a second?
Do you have to pee again?
4 coffees.
A third pee?
I have to pee again too.
You
do? That'll be my third pee for this podcast.
Oh my God. 3 pees per mail.
Yeah.
On this podcast.
I'm trying to drink a gallon of water a day. I drink like 4 or 5 coffees a day.
Breastfeeding makes me so thirsty. I'm supposed to drink 4 liters of water a day. I can drink.
I think that's a gallon.
Yeah, I can drink 1 liter of water in the way that I used to drink 1 cup of water.
Yeah.
Like one glass of water, I could chug a liter like it's nothing now.
I believe that.
It makes you so thirsty.
How bizarre. How bizarre.
Do, 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 do. How bizarre.
How bizarre. Bizarre.
Ooh, baby.
Jagger.
Jagger is just a happy little bean. Jagger was so upset he couldn't sleep on the couch where my dad was sleeping last night. We had to lock him in the bedroom upstairs. He was sleeping on the other side of our door.
I know.
because he just wanted to cuddle with the guest downstairs.
Jagger was pouting in our bedroom all night.
Pouting. You got to come over here so we can finish this up.
Give me your phone. I'm going to take a picture.
Hold on. I'm going to make a video of this for my clip. Okay. Dad's drinking water. And now, tell us, why did you get kicked off Tinder?
It was a silly reason. And it was this. So I said, this one girl I saw, she was kind of attractive. So she texted me back a few pictures. I said, all right, nice. You know,
you said, send me some pictures.
I think I did. I'm trying to remember. Anyway, so we're talking. It was going well. And all of a sudden, she sends me a picture of her feet.
Did you ask for the foot picture?
I did not.
Did she say, I'll send you a picture of my feet for $50?
No, she just sent me a picture of her feet.
Okay.
I look at the feet and I said to myself, these are not good looking feet. Fat, swollen. I was like a little bit annoyed because I never asked for this.
Yeah. And were you like, what the fuck are these ugly feet?
That's what I said to myself. I was trying to be a bit euphemistic about it. However, I did text her back and said, listen, if you ice it, it could bring down the swelling. which I, you know, look, it's a bit sarcastic. Is it really that mean-spirited? I guess a little bit.
And then she reported you for saying you should ice your swollen feet?
And then all of a sudden, a day or two later, I get kicked off of Tinder.
I
asked them why, and they wouldn't answer me.
And
but I'm still on Bumble, thank God.
You're still on Bumble. And let's end with just some general life advice. Whatever comes to mind for some life advice. Just kind of
life advice?
Freestyle.
All right, let me think. All right. Well, let me think. I don't know if it's proverbial, but... Well, I got to make a reference to the book The Artist's Way by Julie Cameron. I see you have that book. I think I
yes.
gave you that book.
No, you didn't.
And that is, in that book, it made mention that all of a sudden she decided she wanted to be a writer, a screenplay writer, a screenwriter. All her friends said, are you crazy? You weren't an English lit major in college. You don't know anything about writing. You know, why don't you just have white wine lunches with us and go to the gym, relax? You know, your ex-husband is taking care of you. She goes, no, I want to do something more with my life. I think I can do it. So that's what I got from the book. And what I learned is that you really got to believe in yourself. You cannot listen to it with anyone else. And people say, oh, you don't know how to do this. Look, I got into writing because I was inspired by that book along with my friend Ken Christensen, who's one of the writers for The Punisher on that TV. I think it was on Netflix. And he got me into writing too because he said, listen, a lot about writing is personality.
Hmm.
And it's like any, it's a craft, like anything. You know, you stick with it and you become, and they always say, you know, if you really want to be a writer, you got to become a voracious reader, which I have always was. Pretty much a very good, you know, I read a lot. And I, myself included, I never thought that I could do it. But I mean, I did think I could do it, but I was a bit apprehensive. But after I read the book and after Ken, I started writing. And it's like any craft, you know, you get better at it and better if you stick with it. And I wound up having 4 different plays off Broadway. I had one at the Manhattan Theater Club. I had one at the Chelsea Guild Theater where I had Keith Richards' daughter in my play, and I won an award for that. I was at the American Theater of Actors for this play, His and Hers. And then I started writing, those were plays I had written. I started out writing plays, and then I wrote some screenplays that I placed at the Austin screenwriting contest. I think it's like number 2, Nichols number 1. I placed twice as a quarterfinalist for 2 of my screenplays. Page, screenwriting, final draft. I placed them, a number of them, so I'm still trying to pursue that. But with regard to personal achievements, how to achieve, as apart from believing in yourself, you really got to stay with it.
Yeah.
And you watch all the time, people who win awards, they say, they stick with me, stay with me. I believe that I could do it. You can't give up. I think Stephen
King... Why do so many people... say negative things and shit on artists when they're on their way. Why do you think that is?
Jealousy.
There it is. Okay.
And jealousy. That's what it is.
Okay.
It's a subconscious jealousy.
Wow. Like, I couldn't do this.
Stephen King, I think, sent his scripts out to 100 people before the 101st took it.
Mm.
You know, because writing, you know, story, it's very subjective. Plays, you know, art is subjective. Theater is subjective. A film, you know, we can go to see a film. You can say, I love it. Another person says, I hate it. The same with fashion, you know. But if you got to really believe in yourself, and you can't, if you really truly believe that you could do it, you can, you have to stay with it, anything.
Can I tell my, so this speaks to your character and who you are behind closed doors. So I was almost married before 7-8 years ago. I go to ask permission from the woman's father, and he goes, took a huge bite of steak, and he goes, I think you're a good guy, Stephen. You can marry my daughter. When are you going to quit this little comedy thing? And I was just shocked, right? And I go, and I was like scared of this guy. I was like 30 at the time or 29. I go, you know, when I'm 35, he goes, all right, I'm holding you to that. You're quitting your little dream at 35. I couldn't believe someone said that. Fast forward, we break up. I never get married. We break up years later. I fly out to New York to ask permission to marry Chelsea.
I'm seeing a pattern.
And what?
No, I'm joking. No. Of you going to ask.
Well, you ask permission. You're seeing the pattern of a gentleman is what you're seeing. Yeah. I know that doesn't happen too much these days, but I'm a gentleman.
Okay.
So I asked Michael. He says, Stephen, I think you're a great guy. I give you permission on the agreement that you and Chelsea both hit it hard and don't give up on your dreams.
That's right.
And that's, I mean, do you see the difference of who the right person was?
That's what you said. You just can't give up on your dreams. You can't. And I give you permission. Yeah.
Are you surprised?
It's like anything. You stay with it, you'll get better at it.
Yeah.
You will get better, but you got to be committed.
Yep, I'm all in.
Are you surprised I got married? A little?
No.
Because catch.
Women, like, they get mid-30s, you know, what are you going to go to the clubs? When you, you know, after a while, it's like, you know, it's like that that comedian, which I love. Well, there's two comedians, Bill Burr.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bill Burr.
And Sebastian Maniscalco.
Maniscalco.
Yeah. He did that one skit where he had said he goes into a club and he goes, isn't it loud in here?
Yeah.
He's so funny.
That's when you realize you're too old.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Dad, for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome.
Have like a social media? You're not a big social media guy, right?
No. I'm on LinkedIn. That's all.
Go to LinkedIn.
No. Yeah. Thank you. All right.
Well, so long.
All right. Bye guys.
Bye.